I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. I'm really delighted to have Christine Sine on. She's a contemplative Christian, an author, a teacher, a gardener, and the executive director of Mustard Seed Associates. She lives with her husband, Tom, in Seattle, and she focuses a lot of her work on fostering and providing resources for spiritual formation. Thank you so much, Christine, for being my guest today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a delight to be with you, Lisa.
And so maybe you can get us started with, how did you transition into this area of focus of spiritual formation and the website and Mustard Seed Associates? Because I know that you started out in the medical field and working on mercy ships.
That's right. Hopefully people can still tell that I did not grow up in Seattle, which is where I live now. I grew up in Australia, trained there as a medical doctor, then moved to New Zealand and was in New Zealand for several years before I felt God call me to the Mercy Ships, which at that point, actually, this was 1980, and the Mercy Ship was basically an old ship in Greece being renovated. And so I had the privilege of developing the whole medical side of Mercy Ships and then doing the first operations that were done on board and, kind of really setting up and what I can see now has developed into an incredible ministry. Part of that time, I spent in the mid-80s, I spent a couple of months, it was only a couple of months, in the refugee camps on the Thai-Cambodian border. And it was life-transforming for me. You know, part of what it did, I mean, I literally had kids dying in my arms. And I found myself, you know, asking questions about, firstly, does God care? But secondly, if God does care, you know, kind of, what does this mean for me and even the whole aspect of health and wholeness? What is health and wholeness really all about? And then when I worked in Africa, one of the things that I discovered was, you know, for Africans, health was not a physical thing. It was a spiritual thing. And so, again, it raised more questions about, you know, what is God's view of health and wholeness? And out of that, I started doing a lot of study, particularly around the concept of shalom, which is the Hebrew word basically for God's desire to see all things made whole. And so it was out of that background when in 1992 I married my husband, who was American, settled in the States, I decided not to register myself as a medical doctor here in the United States because I wanted to really look at and pursue a broader understanding of health and wholeness from God's perspective and looking at, you know, God's desire to see all things made new. And for me, that was particularly looking at God's desire to see us made whole, which was a lot of the focus that then I started to put onto spiritual formation, to see God's creation made whole. And so for me, environmentalism, our connection to the earth became very important, to see our neighbors made whole. So concerns for social justice became a very important part of that. And, of course, to see our relationship to God made whole. And, of course, that brought, again, other dimensions of spiritual formation into it. So this, for me, is God's view of health and wholeness. And so it seemed a very natural progression out of my medical practice as I settled here in the States. And I am more and more convinced of that. And that even though I think medicine is important, it's only a very small part of God's plan for health and wholeness.
That is a really important point that we sometimes will think wholeness has one dimension when, of course, it has to involve all of us because we are connected in so many ways in our lives, relationally and mentally and physically, and, of course, to the creation, to the whole of creation. And does this play into Celtic spirituality too? And maybe you can go into what that even means to people who are unfamiliar with that.
Oh, very much. As I said, in Africa, I started to recognize that, you know, spirituality was very much at the center of health. And so part of, and also that spirituality really wove through all of life. for many Africans. And so, you know, again, I came back to the first world countries thinking, well, you know, why isn't this the case in the way we practice faith in Western culture? And so it was out of that. My husband was already interested in Celtic Christian spirituality. And part of what drew me to this was the fact that it seemed to be a faith that it had prayers for every part of life. It had a sense of, really drawing people into a faith that impacted everything that they did. And for those that don't know, Celtic Christian spirituality really thrived between about the 400s and the 800s. And it the well-known saints, I suppose you could say, Patrick and Columba and Bridget, were people that really loved God, loved creation, loved people. And wove their prayers and their practices around all of these. Just prayers for milking the cows, prayers for lighting the fire, prayers for going on a journey, prayers for protection from God, a very wonderful sense of our intimate involvement with God, with Christ. You know, some of the prayers say things like Christ behind me, Christ before me, Christ beside me, Christ to hold me, that really wonderful sense of intimacy. And it was part of this that really helped me to start to see, you know, these wonderful connections between our spiritual formation and the earth and the everyday things that we do and, you know, really wanting to enter into that. So it's been very important for me, that branch of Christianity.
One thing I've been so surprised and delighted by, the difference between Celtic spirituality and maybe the kind of spirituality influenced more by Rome and some of the Roman Empire kind of influenced spirituality, is that God seems to be much more available and accessible, and there isn't the kind of hierarchy that you see. You don't see the same sort of hierarchy going on in Celtic spirituality, and you see more equality between male and female, and there's just a difference. And what I've heard is that way off in Ireland and in the Celtic territories, Christianity kind of got there last from the early church, kind of got there last and sort of was untouched in the Roman Empire because it was such a distant place. And so it was sort of untouched by the Roman Empire when Christianity was co-opted with the government. And so it kind of retained some of that original the original stuff that maybe the first church would have been employing, and then that connection with God as being, you know, God isn't this distant, far off, you have to have a priest to get in contact with him. So there's this sort of rich, vibrant connection with God and nature, and men and women are more equal. And there's just this sort of vibrancy there it's really powerful. And I've really appreciated delving into more of these Celtic prayers and this connection that nature is good and that we can appreciate all these things. And I guess that really ties in well with what you do with gardening. Maybe you can talk about some of that part of your life. It's such a big part of your life.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let me comment on what you said first, because I think that you're right. I think that partly probably because of the nature of the people who, you know, kind of were first exposed to Celtic Christian spirituality, there was a difference. There were some connections to Rome, but it very much grew up as its own kind of brand of faith. And there was this sense, you know, the sense of connection to the Trinity, not as hierarchy, but as family. You know, in fact, it was believed that every clan was a representation of the Trinity in many ways, which is beautiful. And yes, sometimes women led the monasteries as well as men. Bridget, you know, who is one of my favorites, was, you know, the abbess at the monastery of Kildare. And there was very much, there was a connection to the poor rather than the wealthy. And in fact, that was one of the big conflicts, you know, that kind of happened and unfortunately, to a certain extent, saw the demise of the Celtic Church. Because, of course, with the Roman Church coming up from the south, from England, and the Celtic Church, and with the focus on the wealthy and the Celtic Church coming down, as it were, from the north, with its focus to a greater extent on the poor, you can understand which one won out, because the kings and queens and rulers, you know, they wanted to go with the wealthy, not with the poor. And so that was part of, you know, kind of what happened, unfortunately. But, you know, I mean, it's still there. And of course, fortunately, in the 1800s, many of these beautiful prayers were collected that had survived for centuries amongst the common people, the people for whom this was still very much their way of connection to God. And part of the belief, you know, the Celtic Christians was that creation was translucent and that the glory of God shone through it. And so that's that wonderful connection to creation. You know, as part of what has really, I suppose you could say, enlivened me as I have worked in the garden. You know, I've always loved gardening, but to be honest, it only became a passion for me as I started to recognize not just the presence of God in the garden, but the ways in which the story of God unfolded, I should say, in the garden. I mean, in the season of Easter, for example, you know, the death and resurrection. In fact, Celtic Christians would plant their seeds as often as possible on a Friday, always as a symbol of death and resurrection. And in fact, they would sprinkle it with water 2 or 3 days beforehand, so that the whole, you know, the idea of death and resurrection was really entwined with every seed that they planted, which I think is just beautiful. And then, you know, many of their prayers, you know, there is this wonderful sense of the enlivening of God in the creation. And I love that sense. And so part of what it has done for me is to really open my eyes to see the unfolding of God. You know, I tell people my favorite part of the garden is the compost pile. It gives me such hope. You know, I look, and to me, it never stops giving me a sense of awe. You think about it. We put in garbage. We put in our kitchen waste. We put in everything that we want to get rid of from the garden. And God transforms it into what gardeners call black gold. You know, the most precious stuff that we put on our gardens. And I think, wow. You know, if God can transform this, it gives me hope that God can transform all of the garbage still in my life and make it into gold. And it's out of that then that, you know, other plants and other people and other parts of God's creation can flourish as well. And so I just love those kinds of connections.
Absolutely. And it's one of these things we see as a miracle. But this is the ordinary way of nature and God's design. It's the ordinary way things work, is that the bad is redeemed all the time into this nutrients for new life. I think it's a beautiful picture of the nature of things woven into nature itself that can be a metaphor for our own lives and our own compost.
Oh, exactly. You know, I mean, Orthodox Christians believe that God speaks through two books, the book of the Bible and the book of creation. And I think it's true. And I think that, you know, Protestants in particular have for so long neglected that second book of God. You know, one of the things that I've loved to see over the last 7 or 8 years with the growth of the community garden movement, which has spread into the church, is people starting to reconnect not just to the earth, but to the story of God expressed through the earth. And it's just beautiful to see, you know, some of the reflections that are coming out of that, some of the, you know, the richness, and that you can see people's faith in so many cases coming to life. Because I think, you know, when we disconnect from the earth, we disconnect from God to a certain extent. You know, we forget that, you know, that Genesis story of God taking earth And I don't like actually the rendition dust, because that to me sounds very sterile. But I think that God reached down into the rich, loamy soil of the earth that was already alive with incredible life, you know, microbes and worms and all kinds of things, and breathed, first of all, probably breathed that wonderful smell into himself, and then breathed on that earth and created humankind. And we of course, were created to look after the earth. And we are created from the earth in this wonderful way, and there's this intimate connection. And getting back to the health things, you know, there are very, it's interesting, some of the studies being done recently that show that getting out in the garden increases our joy, it improves our health, physical health, it improves our emotional health, and it obviously improves our spiritual health. So, you know, we're meant to be connected in this way, and part of the wholeness God desires for us, I think, is intimately connected with the earth. And now, that doesn't mean that everybody has to become a gardener, but I think we need some forms of connection to the earth. You know, maybe we like to go hiking. Maybe we like to sit by the sea and watch the waves. You know, maybe we like to be bird watchers, or, you know, there is something, I think, that all of us need to think about of how can we connect to God's earth in a way that's going to enrich our faith. I think it's really important for us.
Now, when you were younger and you were growing up and being spiritually formed, was this connection to the earth not present in your life, or what was your spiritual or religious background?
Well, it's very complex, actually. I grew up in a family that my father was Greek, my mother was Scottish, and so I kind of grew up between the Presbyterian and the Greek Orthodox Church. Very different expressions of faith. And then, you know, when I was about 12 or 13, my parents actually stopped going to church. And so for a while, I grew up without church at all. And then I, when I was at university, became involved in the charismatic movement in Australia, which was really what brought my faith to life. And then when I practiced in New Zealand, I went to a Pentecostal church in New Zealand. And Mercy Ships, which was a part of Youth with a Mission when I was involved with it, you know, comes out of course, the charismatic side of the church. But because we traveled so much, you know, at that stage, I would go to any church and often would get asked to speak in different places. And so it was a really interesting kind of and enriching experience, because I really did get to be involved with many faith dimension, you know, faith expressions, I should say, mainly on the Protestant side of the church, though, as I said, also the Orthodox. At one point, I had the opportunity to go to St. Catherine's Monastery in the Sinai Desert, and that is the oldest continually occupied monastery in the world. It goes back to the 300s. And it gave me a sense of the richness of that tradition, which even though I'd grown up on the edges of the Greek Orthodox Church, because I didn't speak Greek, you know, it didn't have a great deal of meaning for me. But so part of the privilege of my life has been the opportunity to be involved with, to be touched by, and to be formed by, I think, virtually every Christian denomination, both Catholic and Protestant as well. And I found enrichment from all of these. You know, it makes me realize that when we focus on our own expression of Christian faith, we miss a lot. We need listening to the voices of people who see God in very different ways. And of course, as I've traveled in the world, I've realized that people in other countries see faith in different ways too, and again, there's much to learn from that, as well as from the historical church. So much variety that has formed my Christian faith.
Yes, there's cultural expressions, there's historic expressions, and I think that it is a banquet table that I think that we're invited I've noticed too, as I've just reading Christian history and seeing the different movements throughout history and seeing the Spirit move in people and in movements, that there's a lot to draw from there. And it seems silly to just think that in your little sphere where you happen to be growing up in your little time period and your little culture, that that would be the 100% way to worship and love God. It just seems
definitely. And of course, part of that, I think part of the privilege that we have in this day and age with the internet and so much that's available is that we can tap into these things so easily. You know, we can learn about Christians from 2,000 years ago as well as 2,000 miles away. You know, we can interact with them in a way that has never been possible before. And hopefully, you know, those interactions will always enrich our faith. You know, as we focus on the need to learn, I think that's one of the things that has been most important for me, particularly over the last 10 years or so, is realizing I have far more to learn than I have to teach. That, you know, the world is alive with the presence of God, and we need to be looking for the presence of God and listening for the presence of God in every situation that we find ourselves in. Rather than thinking, I'm taking God out there, I've got to tell others about God. Because when we do that, we really truncate God's ability, I think, to help us grow into a richer and a greater faith.
Yeah, that's something that my own spiritual director, who was trained in Ignatius spirituality, was saying. God is at work in all things. And it really flips it around. It's like, wake up to what God is already doing and join God in the work, in the divine love and the work of healing the world. It's not like you're, you know, grabbing God's hand and saying, come on with me, God, and let's work over here.
Exactly. And it takes a lot of the burden from us, you know, because if we go out with that feeling of we've got to change the world, it's a heavy burden to carry. But if we go out with the attitude of God is in the business of changing the world, where can I see God at work and how can I join that work? It's an exciting business because, you know, we're looking. It's like going out in springtime and looking for where the daffodils have emerged, or, you know, where the tulips are coming up. There's excitement to that. You know, and it's a beautiful new way of doing things that I think we can very easily miss out on if we go out with the burden of we're the ones that have got to do everything, which unfortunately is a lot of the way that, you know, evangelical Christian faith has tended to go out. And I've certainly suffered with that, as a result have gone through burnout. And I think many of us do, you know, because we can't relax into the presence of God and enjoy the presence of God and say, oh, God, how do you want me to be a part of this? And in that regard, you know, I love the Jewish view of the day, which doesn't start as we tend to think of the day starting at dawn, but it starts at dusk. And it starts basically with us going to sleep and us resting and God at work. And so when we get up in the morning, there is much more that sense of we are joining God in the work that God has already begun. And even, you know, the liturgical year has that same kind of pattern to it. You know, the liturgical year, the Christian year, starts with the season of Advent, you know, which, of course, in the Northern Hemisphere is a season of rest and of waiting, of inactivity from a personal perspective. And then, you know, but of kind of building up reserves so that we can enter into the work that God wants us to do at the right season. And those kinds of understandings have brought a lot more relaxation to my life, and I think can to all of our lives in a way that is really important for us.
And so with the work that you're doing with Godspace and Mustard Seed Associates, you've drawn from a lot of different places and made things really available for people. I've been personally really have benefited through the years of going to Godspace. It's taken different incarnations. I think you maybe have had different websites, and perhaps you could explain what you're up to there and what people can expect if they go to your website and draw from what you have there.
Okay. Yeah. Godspace, which is godspace-msa.com, started as my own personal blog. But it's very much become a resource center for people who are looking for creative approaches to spiritual practices, I think. Every liturgical season I post resources, but trying to focus particularly on resources that help connect us to creativity. One of the things that I love to do, for example, is to create gardens that reflect the liturgical season. And usually in those gardens, I have rocks that I've written on, that I've painted pictures on, that are things that, and these are usually little gardens that I place on my desk as a way to focus. And so, you know, providing tools like that and other forms of creativity, of people that write on things like collage journaling, on, you know, creative ways to practice the different seasons, very much trying to encourage these kinds of focuses, as well as a lot of resources for spirituality and gardening, and things that connect us to social justice issues. For example, for Good Friday, I have a series of resources for Stations of the Cross, and a number of those Stations of the Cross with a real social justice issue, one with Iraqi refugees as the people that are walking with Jesus towards the cross. And, you know, those kinds of issues that I think are very important. Another one that focuses on immigration and Stations of the Cross. So trying to help people kind of grapple with some of our everyday issues rather than just looking historically at these kinds of liturgical symbols is a lot of what I'm about. And so these are the kinds of resources on the blog. I now have, it's no longer a personal blog. I have 40 people from around the world, literally, writing for the blog. We seasonally have different kinds of focuses on the blog. We're moving into, of course, what's known as the Easter season, not as well known as the season of Lent. But, you know, the focus for me is on resurrection. I tell people, you know, we forget Easter is not about crucifixion, it's about resurrection. And for many of us, it seems to me still that the journey of Easter ends on Good Friday. And yet it shouldn't. It should end, well, it shouldn't end. It's preparing us for a new beginning. And so the focus after Easter on the blog will be on practicing resurrection. What does that look like? And how can we enter into God's resurrection created world, you know, through entering into justice and generosity and caring and sharing and all of these kinds of things. And these are the things that I really want to highlight on the blog and on the work, in the work that I do.
That's wonderful. That's why I'm going to be working like mad to get this out by in a week and make sure that everybody can be a part of that, because I think it's a beautiful bunch of things you've done and so many things there for people to get a hold of and enrich their lives with, and also their family, because I know that there's a lot of resources there that people can do, like the prayers that you could print out and read at the table during meal times with your children and your family. I know there's things that I've done in that way, or devotional practices. And there's a lot of things there that we will get stuck in our old things without infusing them with new resources that could really enliven things. We can see things from a different perspective. So I really cherish those resources, and I think that a lot of people will benefit from seeking those out.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, and you're right. I particularly, like for each season, I'll always have one resource list. You know, there's one on gardening with kids. There's another one on celebrating Easter with kids. And, you know, because very much I know people are always looking for resources for their family. And again, and to be honest, I find a lot of the resources are a little old-fashioned. You know, it's like, well, that's the way we did it with kids 50 years ago. And so trying again to find some creative ways to help connect people to the seasons that is very appropriate and enriching for their families is a lot of what I really want to do, part of my passion, I think. But, you know, that justice desire is in the midst of that as well.
I'm usually curious to ask people in recent times, what have been books that you have really cherished that have been influential on you spiritually?
It's interesting to me, you know, just looking at books that influence me, I find that it's always a combination of books that I like to come back to over and over again and those that are fresh and are new, you know, and of course there are so many books coming out all the time that it's very challenging sometimes to say, well, this is the one that's impacted me the most. I've just been reading one recently called To the Table, A Spirituality of Food, Farming and Community by Lisa Graham McMinn, that I'm thoroughly enjoying and finding provides a lot of both practical and spiritual insights that I think are really appropriate for today. And then the other one that I'm reading at the moment is called A Spirituality of Listening. It was interesting the other day on Twitter, I had somebody, you know, say something about if, you know, if you can't sleep at night, maybe it's because, you know, God wants to interact with you. And he said, start talking to God. And I thought, no, don't start talking to God, start listening to God. And so, you know, reading this book, A Spirituality of Listening by Keith Anderson, who's the president at Seattle School of Theology and Psychology, is one that I'm really enjoying. So they're the two at the moment that I would say are most impacting me. But, you know, as I said, there are some that I come back to, or some authors that I come back to on a regular basis. I think Henry Nouwen is one of those. Barbara, what's her name? Brown Taylor is another, you know, An Altar in the World. Just a wonderful, wonderful book. And her book, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it, about darkness. It's just an incredible book, and I should be able to remember the name. Anyway, we can, but just mention, you know, if you mention her name, I think that's enough there, because, you know, her books are tremendously good for those who are looking for a broader perspective of spirituality. Barbara Brown Taylor, really enriching. So those would be some that I would heartily recommend. Oh, actually, one more. Christine Valters Paintner has written some beautiful books on spirituality, and the two of hers that I love is she has a book on Lectio Divina that is one of the best, very practical but insightful books on Lectio Divina, and she has another one on photography as spiritual practice. You know, something we don't think about, but we live in such a visual world and in a world in which everybody's taking photographs.
Yes.
So her insights into that and how we can make photography into a spiritual practice are things that I have found very enlightening and very enriching.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that. That's great. And with being a contemplative Christian, when you speak about listening, that has a much fuller meaning than maybe people are going to even grasp, because we, contemplative Christianity has a lot to do with the apophatic or the praying without words and listening to God, not just chattering on and thinking of prayer as something where we're going to do all the talking and God's going to do all the listening. Maybe you can speak a little bit to what does it mean for you to be a contemplative Christian and have contemplative spirituality as a mainstay in your relationship with God?
Well, let me just say before I talk much about that is I have had no formal training in contemplation or in spiritual formation. You know, it's more come from my own reading and from my own practice. So to a certain extent, my way of doing it is probably a little different. But, you know, which of course for me has been wonderful. For me, listening, you know, I mean, I have a quiet time still every morning, but it looks very different now than it did even 10 years ago. I sit at my desk where I can look out on the Olympic Mountains, and sometimes I will just sit there and I will look at the mountains. And often I find God speaks to me through that. And then what I'll usually find is words start revolving around my mind. And sometimes I'll write down a phrase that then I'll reflect on that. Sometimes it's a word from the scripture. Sometimes it's something else. And then often for me, out of that will come a prayer or a poem. I write a lot of liturgical kind of prayers and poems these days that have very much come out of my listening to God. And often, more about my need than God's speaking to me about, okay, here's what you need to be doing type of thing. In fact, I'd like to read one of those prayers. That one of the ones I have some of them on cards, and I keep them on my desk so that I can go back to them and just remind myself of them. And I write a lot of prayers that talk about breathing. A lot of prayers that talk about resting in the moment, because I think that the whole ability to listen is very much about sitting in the moment and recognizing the presence of God in the moment, rather than kind of looking to the future or looking to the past. But I find too, and partly because of the way I've been brought up and trained, I need constant reminders of that. So let me just read this. Rest in the moment, breathe, look, listen, savor what is now. Rest in the moment, enjoy God's rainbow colors. Let their beauty fill you, their glory speak to you, their mystery lodge in your soul. Rest in the moment, sit in peace, share love, enjoy life. Find God. And those kinds of prayers just, I find, have really, they've come out of my listening, and they've become the heart of my contemplation. And just enrich my life in wonderful ways as well.
We should probably end there, because that's just so beautiful. I would hate to trample on that. And I would be so delighted if you would come back on the show once again in the future and share more with us.
I would love to do that. I love talking about these things and, of course, writing about them. I have several books that I've written on more contemplative kind of practices, Return to Our Senses, Reimagining How We Pray, which talks a lot about some of these things that I'm talking about here as well.
I will be sure to add all those to the show notes for this episode, and as well as links to your website and your Twitter, which I realized you were on Twitter in the infancy of Twitter in 2008, incredibly, one of the early adopters.
I'm a techie.
Yes, apparently.
I'm 65, but I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Facebook, I'm on YouTube, I'm on Pinterest, so this is me.
Yes, absolutely. And it's wonderful to be able to find you and see what you're doing, and that you're that accessible, that we can look to see what you're doing and look at the beautiful pictures that you post. I deeply appreciate it. And I was like, oh, I wonder if she has Instagram. Well, there she is. You're easily findable, so you could be Googled, and you have a lot of Google juice out there that people can find you as well. But this has been such a delight and pleasure, and I know that people are going to get a lot out of it. And so I thank you so much for spending some time with me and my listeners.
Oh, thanks, Lisa. It's been fun. I really enjoyed it. Blessings on you and all that you're doing.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too. Please stop by and check it out.